The Fried Egg Superintendent Series is brought to you by Toro. Among the countless reasons why we go to the course, communing with Mother Nature sits near the top of most lists. And the company most trusted to responsibly maintain our golf environments, Toro, continues to lead the way. Its line of all-electric and hybrid mowers and vehicles do their jobs as well as ever. Better, actually, because while their precision, power, reliability, and comfort remain the same, this new breed reduces engine exhaust emissions, noise pollution, and increases efficiency and ease of maintenance. If only our golf swings were that productive and sustainable. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
All right, welcome back to another edition of our Superintendent Series on the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's guest is the Director of Grounds at Essex County Club in Manchester-by-the-Sea, Massachusetts. A wonderful place. It is the sixth member of the USGA and a fantastic Donald Ross design. This is Eric Richardson. He's been there for a while and a wonderful guest. So, Michigan State turf grad, and we were out at the GCSAA show. We were actually out at the golf tournament, which was presented by Toro, so it was wonderful to be out there and mingle with superintendents from all over the country. So without further ado, here is Eric Richardson.
Do Boston people fit the stereotype? Are they as angry as they say they are?
I would say all stereotypes have a smidgen of truth, but I would call them salty, not angry. But once they welcome you in, they treat you like family. But they have to accept you. It's not, you can't force your way in.
My first job out of college was a sales job, and it was a trucking sales job. So, like, shit goes wrong all the time.
That sounds
job.
Enjoyable.
Oh, it was awful. I had this client. He was, like, the angriest person from Brockton, Massachusetts. Yep. He used to call, like, when I was out, and people would be like, how do you deal with that guy? But, like, when you did a good job, he was, like, incredibly nice, like, and he was, you know, but then if you screwed up, he told you.
But you always knew where you stood, right?
Always.
And so you didn't. There was no interpretation. You always, and that's actually what I appreciate most about the people in New England is that you always know where you stand. And being a golf course superintendent, you know, sometimes the politics get a little iffy. But when you have people that are bluntly honest with you, you know, it's easier for me to take.
You've been at Essex since 2007?
It will be my 15-year anniversary on March 1st.
It's a long time.
I've been doing this since I was 19 on golf, in terms of managing golf turf, so almost 24 years. And I've been in turf management since I was 11 years old, pushing a mower around suburban Los Angeles.
L.A. to Boston. Are you a Lakers fan?
Diehard Lakers fan, diehard Rams fan, diehard Dodger fan. So, and, you know, I can't stand Tom Brady. So the people in Boston, I'm sorry, but yeah, you know, A, he went to Michigan. Can't root for anybody who went to Michigan, and B, can't root for the Patriots.
It's fine. I grew up a huge Michigan fan because of the Fab Five.
Yep.
And then I just have the vivid memory. Like when I think about Tom Brady, yep. I think about that Orange Bowl yep. against Alabama. Yep.
And Sean Alexander is the running
yeah,
back, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. David Terrell.
Yep.
I played a hole of golf with David Terrell
oh,
when
really?
I was a kid. Yeah. Him and Brian Urlacher were in the group behind me and a buddy. We were playing at the local course because yep. they practiced in next to the yep. town, the town next to where I grew up. And we knew they were behind us. They were like three holes behind us and nobody else was on the course. So we just sat on a tee and waited for them to get there.
I find funny about the Fab Five is in everybody thinks they won a title.
Yeah.
They lost in the finals both years until you know the Chris Webber's freshman year and his sophomore year. But people think they won a title. They didn't win anything.
So how did you get out to Boston? Is it just the way of like the turf life where you just kind of follow the jobs?
Yeah, so I was guided by my professor at Michigan State to, because I, you know, originally I was going to do a internship at.
You were same as Kyle Hegland, right?
Yeah, and, same with Kyle Hegland. Dan Meersman was, you know, mm-hmm. part of our. So yeah, we had a good group. Adam Mikamis, who's the executive director of the Michigan GCSAA. So we had a great group of people. Not many are left in turf, but. Yeah, I was dead set in going back to L.A. to go to LACC or Bel Air for an internship. And then, you know, when my grandfather passed, and I'm like, well, I don't need to go back to Southern California. I want to experience something new, something I haven't experienced at all. And I was in line to go to the country club in Brookline, you know, as a young kid. And I was, you know, at that time, Bill Spence was doing, he had like 8 or 9 interns. And my professor, Trey Rogers, told me, like, all you're going to do is push a mower around. Go to this cool little quirky golf course, and they're going to treat you like an assistant. I was at Myopia Hunt Club, and got to work for David Hiroian, and really fell in love with old school architecture, and just became, you know, a golf nerd, you know? And it ate it up till today. Yeah.
So then, how long were you at Myopia?
So I didn't. I went back there after. So after school, I graduated. I was able to go do work as a second assistant for John Jennings at Chicago Golf Club, which only. Furthered my passion for these old school golf courses. And then Dave called and said, you want the first assistant job? Because my first assistant's leaving. I said, okay, when do you want me to start? It was like 2 weeks later, and I jump onto I-90 in the middle of a nor'easter snowstorm and pulling a little trailer in my, you know, Pontiac Grand Am, you know, and then I found my way to Boston and haven't left since.
What a little lineage, you know, Myopia, Chicago, quick stop in Chicago. Oh,
yep.
And then back to Myopia.
But, you know, it's just, you know, you fall in love with these old world clubs, and, you know, and it's not about how lush the golf course is. It's about how the ball moves to the property and just the history, you know, and these old buildings, the old, I mean, really Yankee clubs where, you know, they deferred a lot of maintenance, but sometimes that adds a considerable amount of character to a property.
I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions sometimes about really great, some of the greatest courses is that there is some element of being like a little rough around the edges, whether it's like not being afraid to let the rough just brown out, like, oh, it hasn't rained in 3 weeks, like it's brown, like that's the way.
But
it
that's
is
character.
Yeah,
that's what tells the story of the property. And you know, rustic to me is perfection. Like, it's not like, people are going to hate me for saying this, but I can't stand watching the Masters. I watch every bit of it.
Look at that take
right
at right
out of the gate. I'm not shy. I'm opinionated, and everybody will realize that after this. There's no question. I'm gonna have to.
You're a Boston person at heart.
Yes, I am. But you know, like, it lush and perfect, and the perception of perfection, because Augusta's not perfect. It's the perception that it's perfect. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just not golf to me.
Well, that's something I had never walked around there until a few years ago, and my buddy always gives me shit because I was out there. And I had my camera, and I was standing in a grove of trees taking pictures up. Because, like, if you go walk through, like, some of the groves of trees, there's dead trees everywhere. And it's like, well, like, why are there the dead baby trees? It's like, why'd you plant a baby little tree in a grove of trees?
Well, I would prefer the dead tree to be on, you know, within the site of the golf hole, so it shows some character of the property, you know. And that's, you know, Bill Corr and, you know, Crenshaw and those guys, they like showcasing those old dead trees on the property. And we do that same kind of thing at Essex. But yeah, it's the perception that it's perfect. It's not perfect.
I know. Everybody, every golf course has issues. There is no perfect golf course. Like, every single one. And I think that's, like, one of the things, one of my pet peeves is, like, how, like, if you say a bad word about one bad word about, you know, any course, like, oh, like, you know, you're hating on it. It's like, no, every course has issues.
But every golfer is critical by nature. Like, we all critique every golf course we play. And
every
critique our game, everything.
Self-critical, because there's the only way you could love the game is if you hate your own game.
Yeah, you hate yourself, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So,
that's why I hate my golf course. I hate the club, because sometimes the things that we can fix, we haven't gotten to, and it drives me insane. That's what I see when I play Essex, or I'm working on a day-to-day basis. I don't see all the positives. I see all the negatives.
What drives you the most nuts about your golf
Soft
course?
Soft turf.
Like 18?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, this past year was a, you know, record breaker in terms of precip, but, you know, it's a heavy soil site. So it's either soft or wet. There's nothing in between when you have clay soils. So when it's firm and it's dry, we had 2020 was a challenge from top to bottom in terms of COVID and staffing levels, but we were in a drought, which made me smile because I can then, you're given a control-free control, right? And good things happen when that occurs.
Are most superintendents control freaks, would you say?
99.999% of them, yes. And you have to be because, you know, it's just, it's a big piece of property. You're managing the number one asset at the club. Like you can, no offense to anybody that operates clubhouses, but that clubhouse can burn down. Your club can still exist. Golf course goes away. You know, you're not going to exist. You're not going to survive.
It's funny because like you say that, and I think some people would contend that, but then COVID 2020 happened and everybody realized that the golf course was the thing that mattered the most and the only thing that mattered. You
know, that was the silver lining of 2020. It brought people back. Like golf has been struggling since the recession and it brought people back, and it brought people back in the right way because we weren't putting people in carts. They were walking. They were taking pull carts. They're experiencing golf in my mind how it should be experienced on foot.
Did you notice like a huge difference between, you know, like you're at Essex, it's not like you have like a ton of play, but it's not like you're running rounds like Rancho Park, right?
Correct.
But not having carts, how big of a difference did that make? Even with, you know, not a huge cart trap, you're not a huge cart traffic.
No,
club.
we have 30 golf carts total. So even the 85 year olds walk 18. So it's a great culture, but you know, but we were forced to use tee times. Like the clubs never use tee times. Like a couple events here and there, but no tee times. But when the tee times opened up on the portal, everybody felt like they need to be filled. Yeah. So it was like a race to get your tee time. I hated that, but it brought more people to golf because we have a big rackets program, which is very successful. But it brought a lot of tennis players to golf. It brought a lot of young people to golf. Brought a lot of females to the golf course, and that's what golf needs. It needs more diversification, not just a bunch of us, you know, middle-aged white guys playing golf.
I want to clarify. I don't hate like golf being popular. As a procrastinator, I hate when tee times are the avenue that you have to go, which is 90%, 99% of golf is tee time oriented. But it's like I can't make a decision right away. I like to push the decision off as long as I can.
Well, I mean, Essex is great because you come on a Saturday morning and they call it the ball toss. So it doesn't matter who you are, who you want to play with. They throw all the balls in a hat. They throw them up in the air. And you go play with whoever's you know, teamed up together. And that's how golf should be. It's about making those connections with people you don't normally make connections with.
So is myopia, isn't there some sort of like relationship with myopia and Essex that goes way back, right?
Yeah, way back. Sister clubs. We support each other, but we also want to beat each other. So it's competition, too. You know, completely different personalities. Essex is a little more casual, a little more laid back. Myopia is like, you know, going back in time. But completely different golf courses too, like polar opposites. You know, Myopia's got these tiny, you can fit all 18 Myopia greens on our front nine. That's how small they are. And they're pitched. They don't have a lot of movement. It's a fun golf course, quirky golf course, enjoyable history. And then you go to Essex where we have a lot bigger scale. Things are wider, a little more forgiving for the lesser golfers, particularly at the beginning parts of the fairway, which is what Bruce Hepner did when he first started, was kind of widen these landing zones and pinch them in the right spots for the tougher golfer. So even the myopics that come over and play Essex will begrudgingly tell you they enjoy their round better at Essex than they do at Myopia.
It's you know, that's I had never been up to Boston ever in my life, really, outside of like just flying into the airport once before this year. One of the things that I was like really taken aback of by the golf all the way down to George Wright, the municipal, was like how much it of character and how much it embraced, like the golf courses embrace their natural setting. It was something that really, you know, just like kind of shocked me. As obviously I'm in Chicago, everything's like flat and stuff, but like you go to LA and it's like they just like most courses try and like present this setting that doesn't look at all like LA. And it's like you have this beautiful setting that you try and stray away from. But Boston, I felt like everything just like really was like, you know, you get these rock outcroppings, it's just like a beautiful landscape. Talk about the work that you've done with Bruce Hepner in getting Essex back to that.
So when I started March 1st, 2007, and Bruce had been there since 2001. So Bruce did a lot of work with the mowing lines. And so, but the club latched on to Bruce because Bruce is great in a room. Like, he's fantastic with a membership, very positive, gets people to buy in quickly. So the first thing they did was change the mowing line. So they pulled all the ball washers and all the extra garbage that doesn't need to be trinkets on the golf course. Trinkets. I'll use that. Cart signs. And so we went to more of a minimalist approach on the property. But really, white, like the
people, people survive not having the ball washer.
I can't remember the last time I used a ball washer. Just out of spite, I won't use it. Those things are like, you know, all in like $600 a piece. It's like, I'd rather spend
$600.
Yeah, I mean, the top part's about, for a parade one, is like $350, $400.
Why?
I don't know why. You can dive down that rabbit hole and figure out why, but it's,
I have
it's
used
useless.
A ball washer.
Yep.
And this Curtis James has these like super old school ones from like 1950. No, they're the top, but it's like a wood paddle that you go. They're really cool. They fit the place, right?
Yeah, that's
they're
fine.
Unique.
That's fine. I'm good with that, but you don't need one on every tee. You could have one at the pro shop. You know, I might actually run my cart into it if it's there, but you know, but no, they're like, I clutter on a golf course. It just doesn't belong. You know, everybody's got range finders. Everybody's got their watch. You don't need yardage markers. We don't need yardages on irrigation heads. We need less, not more in golf. And that's what actually drives up the cost of golf too, is all these extra stuff. Where are we going?
Well, $600 for a ball.
Piece.
Think about that at a local level, and it gets passed on.
But then you're also maintaining that. You're filling it. You're paying somebody to put the soap in it, you know, once a week or once every other week. You're paying for the tea towels. Like, there's cost to maintain it as well. So it's a complete waste of money. We kind of went on ball washers, and we're talking about Bruce.
So you took all the trinkets off the course.
Took all the trinkets off. He enlarged the greens considerably back to, you know.
How'd you do that?
Well, they started mowing these things out. So when I
started, they just start mowing them out.
They just start mowing them out. But when I started, the greens were probably 50% grass, 30% dirt, and whatever, 20% moss. So because they just didn't have the budget to kind of maintain these and grow them in properly. But it didn't take us long to kind of fix that. And so the greens got significantly bigger. They went from, I think, 2.75 acres of green space, a greens surface, to 3.1 acres. So, and that's a significant change when you're talking about green space. Mm-hmm. And then he changed the mowing lines on the fairways, which we still have work to do, and we're not there yet. But he significantly, they added about 6 acres of fairway. And again, adding them in the right spots, adding them at the beginnings of the fairways where these lesser golfers can, you know, duff it up there and still enjoy their round and still pinching a little farther up on the hole. Like the first hole is a prime example. The fairway is 65 yards wide at the beginning, and it pinches to about 15 yards wide.
It's a comfy first tee shot.
Yes, it is, and it should be at 434. So after that, you know, Bruce and I kind of developed a relationship, which took a little time because he thought I was just a young kid. I was 28 when I took the job.
That's got to be weird when you come in to a club. You're 28. Your greens committee's like probably averaging 55. Maybe, you know,
a little farther north than that.
You know, and then you've got this architect, like, and the thing, most people are always like, why aren't there any young architects working? Well, like 55-year-olds are hiring this architect, and people hire their peers.
Correct.
So
100%.
And then you come in and you're 28 and you're the everybody assumes you know nothing.
Yeah. So I think as anybody was, everybody's skeptical who you are and whether you have the skills to do the job. But my chairman, this was December of 2007. So we made it through the season, made some big changes agronomically. But then we started the construction work. My chairman's like, I want all those trees in between 15 and 16 cut. And they were all like plantings, like Japanese redwoods and some just like landscape trees. And they went right into the what used to be part of a bunker. So I cut them all down and I just looked at them like, man, we need some help here because the scale isn't right. I called Bruce and we flew him out that day. He jumps in the excavator the next day, and him and I core out the bunker, reshape the whole area, get it regrassed, and it opened up for the spring the next season, and it was a rave success. So we kind of built trust over time, you know, by little projects, and they kept on getting bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of scale. But everything's done in-house at Essex.
I think you like hit on something really big, because I think I see this with a lot of restorations that are, well, restoration, whatever you want to call it. Who knows what a restoration is
call
anymore.
Work. Yeah.
Is like you take out all these trees, but then the scale is completely mismatched.
Correct.
And you know, when you take the trees out, what you're doing, and scale's the most overused term, one of the most overused terms in golf architecture, but when you take the trees out, you're making the scale of the hole bigger. And then what happens is the features of the hole are really small for this correct. New big scale.
But it's not just for that hole, it's for the corridor that we're creating, right? Because yeah. 15 is at 16, 15, 2, ties into 1, ties into 3. So it's the corridor of golf. And so it just, you know, so, and again, it wasn't a massive project. It's a big bunker and some shaping was involved. But that's where I kind of learned how to run an excavator, what Bruce's thoughts were on how the golf course should be presented. But that started the train of work, of in-house work. People think that Essex have made all this big jump because we spent a ton of money and hired all these outside contractors. It's not true. It's Bruce, me, a chainsaw, and an excavator. It's how it's transpired over the last 15 years.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Toro. For more than a century, with cutting-edge turf equipment and irrigation solutions, Toro has had your front nine covered and your back nine too. In fact, Toro's always had your back, period. Toro is as committed to your long-term success as tour pros are committed to their shot. That's down to top-notch customer support from Toro and its dedicated local distributors, both of whom are passionate about delivering turf equipment and irrigation solutions that solve real-world problems. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor today.
The trend seemingly now for restoration has been like, oh, you need to shut down to do this. You need to do that. But then I see like there's a lot of really like courses now that the restorations are older yeah. that get like kind of fly under the radar of great restorations. Like I think about like Shore Acres. Yep. Like Shore Acres underwent like a crazy restoration that was done in-house, you know?
Yeah, but the way we did it was nice because we allowed the master plan to breathe, right? Yeah. It was like a living, breathing document. So we're not like rushing in and trying to get everything done in a six-month period. We're kind of just taking our time and working through the property, making sure, you know, making sure everything we do is a success and expanding upon that every season. So it allows the club to make smart decisions without having to do a broad change over one season. And, you know, and you're not shutting the golf course down for play. People get still going to enjoy their golf course.
Would you say that it allows you to put more attention to detail also into it because you're taking smaller chunks at a time?
Correct. And we're also learning from mistakes and figuring out what pieces of equipment we need. I mean, that may seem minor, but it isn't, you know, especially when you're dealing with hillsides that are built on rock, you know. And but it was it's an interesting way to do it too, because it is the Essex way. Because think, like, Ross was the superintendent. He was the pro. He was the designer. He was there for 5 years. Skip Wogan took over for him. He was the superintendent. He was, you know, did some design work, changed the golf course. Phil Wogan took over for him. Same thing. So it's always been kind of part of Essex where we're not going to do these big, crazy, expensive projects and kind of try to keep it in-house, use in-house talent. We have a decent-sized full-time staff. Because I always say we have two seasons for the maintenance department is maintenance season, which is May 1st through Columbus Day. And then there's construction season, which starts the day after Columbus Day and ends on April 30th.
Yeah. The first time I posted something about Essex, I said something about Ross living there. And I got all these comments about like, oh, yeah, how many places do you live? But this was a place that was like extremely, you know, important and part of his career. Could you talk through like kind of the history I know you're not a historian. You're just a, you know.
I'm not a historian. You guys are much better at that.
I'm not a historian. Garrett's the historian. He's right here.
I mean, there are better historians of the club than me. But I would say he started his work in. I mean, there's still debate on who built the original nine. So we had nine,
which
hole,
includes the bathtub green.
Bathtub green, which we, in quotes, consider the oldest green in continued use in the United States. But
wait, is that? I thought the second green was that.
No, that's the third green. Bathtub green is the third green.
I feel like I heard that when I was on the second green.
And people think that's great. I said it's like, but when you're managing turf, I say it's like managing turf in a toilet bowl.
It's not easy. Nobody has seen this. Like, this green, it's a huge green that on the left side of it, if there's just like, it looks like just like a giant depression. If you're a finer drone before I'd ever see in the course, that are just this like giant hole in the green. It's like but it's not like giant. It's like 6 feet. It's like a bathtub.
It's the size of a bathtub. It's like a clawfoot bathtub. You
have
know?
You guys ever thought about filling it up and putting somebody in it?
Green's chair, different members, absolutely. That one's gonna bite me in the ass later. You don't have to edit that one out either. But it, you know, it's not. You definitely there's no turf book that shows you how to maintain turf in a bathtub either. So it's definitely a challenge. But it's a quirky, cool part of the golf course, and that's like there's no similarity between any hole at Essex. Like they're all different. Even the front nine, whether the hole is difficult or easy, it doesn't matter. They're all different, and that's the best thing about what Ross did was the variety of shots, the angles, the different clubs. Like you just don't hit the same club that often at Essex. But he spent 4 years, you know, 4 years working on the property.
And making changes, right?
Making significant changes, turning the nine holes into 18, turning par threes into par fours. Like the eighth hole was a par three originally.
I wonder if there's any notes of him changing mowing lines.
Oh, well, all the mowing lines were the same. I mean, back then it was a gang mower, so you're mowing rough and fairways the same height. So there's some pictures where they mowed their tees at the same height as greens. I have a picture of the 10th tee with the Curtis sisters. So there's some evidence that they had multiple mowing heights, but the fairways were just it's a meadowland area, just big area mower. So it didn't matter, you know, height of cut wasn't a big deal in the early 1900s, you know.
Yeah, what got me on that is, like, you know, one of the things, like, you hear is with, like, Pinehurst and Essex is, like, the greens close to Ross's houses were always, like, the most interesting greens because he would tweak them, you know?
It's possible, you know, but, I mean, the second green is, you know, stereotypical turtleback, you know, yeah. Ross green. 16 was an original green. So he played with it, played with the surrounds, but that's an original green with just those little subtle movements.
So what got me thinking is like what you said about like I like to tinker with mowing lines. I feel like one of the things that happens is like a course gets its mowing lines, and these are the mowing lines, and we cannot change them.
Yeah,
like there's no rule that says you can't try something and then change it back, right?
I am the person that hates people that put themselves in boxes, right? So you know, and things can change and evolve over time with mowing lines too, you know. But there should be more short grass at Essex, and we're working on that. You know, we've gone as far as we can without updating some more infrastructure. But there should be very little mowed rough and should mainly be fairway height turf.
Are you, when you say infrastructure, are you talking drainage and irrigation?
So I did the irrigation. We did an irrigation install in 2010, and I accidentally laid out all the heads that I needed then. So we don't have to add any more heads. So it's just drainage, and it's just because of the heavy soil makeup of the property. So there's certain areas that are just low lying that when it's wet, it's impossible to grow turf there. But we are making significant improvements. We spent some money this past fall on some drainage, so we're working on it.
Mm-hmm. With the golf course, it's got some distinct areas, and I imagine all of them have their own little quirks and nuances to them.
Yep.
You know, there. I remember we played together when we were out there, and we got to like 8 and 9, and it was like, "Whoa, this is like rock, this is like sand."
Yep.
So And then you've got the heavy clay, and then you go up a mountain on like
built on rock.
Are you trying to create uniform conditions, or is it, you know, or consistent conditions, or are you more, you know, you like rustic? Are you more just like letting it live however it lives?
Well, there's a little bit of everything there, right? So it depends on what Mother Nature's given me, right? 17th is, I mean, we can't even aerate that fairway because it's literally grass on top of rock. There's an inch of, you know, inch of soil and thatch and nothing but pure ledge. So I go grass on rock, I go grass on mud, and I go grass on sand. The 8th and 9th holes are an old gravel pit. That's kind of what they use to kind of build some of the infrastructure around the club. It's the one area that actually drains halfway decent. I just try to create the firmest conditions I can. But every area is going to be a little inconsistent based on its soil, you know, soil makeup. And that's okay. You know, we can get into a big, you know, sand top dressing program of fairways, which would be great. But, you know, it's, you know, sometimes it's okay the way it is. You know, we just need to make sure that we don't have, what we're working on now is just making sure we don't have standing water in certain areas. And that, you know, particularly around the greens, the ball's moving. You know, I can't stand when balls just plug, you know, 5 feet from a green. That's not golf. That's not the way Essex should play.
Yeah, and it is particularly tough for people that don't, like the people that need a little bit more help, you know?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, we have two, our membership's very interesting because they have the missing generation, which is pretty much, you know, from 50 to, well, let's call it 60 now. So you have some of these older golfers that want the extra role, which is great, but in their mind, and we try to create a firm golf course each and every day, but in their mind, firm means easier.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily easier or harder, it's just more enjoyable and funner and more creative, you know? I'd like creative golf and not just target golf. That's not what interests me.
I feel like it firm can be easier when you're really cooking.
If you're moving, that ball's moving anywhere to the left or to the right, you might be DOA.
But, but when you don't have your best stuff, firm gets really hard.
Exactly.
It doesn't give you anywhere to hide.
But it's like this: the membership gets like geeked. Like when they see the golf course goes brown and they're starting to get rolled, they get pumped, which I love to see because they're not worried about it getting too hard, like too hard or too fast. We always have to manage green speeds to make sure we got hole locations that are playable and we're not losing hole locations. But they love the golf course, and they don't want it green. They can't stand green, which I like.
You know, you see all these golfers, it's like a catnip carnival when they post like their goals for a year.
Carnival. I'm gonna use that one.
You guys have an off season, you know, in a way.
Yep.
Do you set goals for like the year?
And
Always.
We always set goals. Like the bar is always raised every year, and I know that's just a
cliche. What are the goals like?
Well, this year is to make sure the golf course plays firmer. You know, we had a significant.
But that's so subjective. Do you have like a?
Yeah.
You know,
we're installing drainage. We're top dressing. We're rolling more. We're lowering more. We do whatever we take. So I'm not a static superintendent. Everything evolves and everything can change and everything can be improved. And that's not just a cliche. That we truly believe that, and we try. That's the goal every year, is to be better. Like I've been the superintendent for 15 years. I've been in this for 24 years, and I still to this day have the passion to be better each and every day and each and every year. And we'll find a way to be better.
So, like a goal could be like I imagine was tree removal for a long time.
It still is.
It still is.
Still is. Yeah, we're not done.
Where do you need to people that would look at photos, obviously. You walk out there and you've got this giant open field that you play in, you know, the first start. And then you go back and there's kind of, it meanders through this property and there's kind of like this back meadow. And then you get up on the gravel pit and then you wind around this giant rock outcropping. And in there, you kind of have forest on one side, rock on the other. So is it mostly in that forest section?
So what happened? So all those areas you're talking about, the rock outcroppings, those were third generation forest. We looked for, some trees that we could be kept to, but there was nothing worthwhile to keep. So those were all dense forests that we removed. We removed almost 20 acres of forest.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on is everybody thought that the front nine and the back nine were not interconnected. So opening those vistas like helped create more uniformity between the front nine and the back nine. And there's just one area in particular that needs to be cut down, and that's between 17 and 16 that kind of goes back towards 15, so that we want to see the second green from the 17th green. All right, so it just opening up these vistas, these corridors of golf, and that's what we've been promoting for over almost 15 years.
Was there a member pushback when you guys undertook this big tree removal?
Of course,
pressure?
Of course there is. And but you just have some good intestinal fortitude, And if you know you're making the right decisions, we made some bold decisions. There's no doubt about it. But we did them in the right way. We did them on the cheap. So they couldn't complain about the finances. We made sure that everything was completed by May 1st. So they weren't looking at construction going on through the season.
Was there ever a time in the middle of one of those? And if so, what was it where you're like, I don't know if this is the right decision?
Of course there is.
Can you give an example?
You're getting me in trouble. So we're clear cutting, essentially clear cutting 5.5 acres between the 18th tee, the 12th tee. So, when you stood on the 18th tee, you could not see the 12th green, the 11th green, the 10th green. You couldn't see any of that. So we're clear-cutting all this. And, my chair, Seth Romans at the time, who really did just let me go, he's like, go for it. I said, okay, we got all the tree removal done in 8 days. Like, significant amount of tree removal. Off, chipped, logs hauled off. And I'm just looking at this hillside going, uh-oh. Now I got to clean all this up. And we got to get it cleaned up before the season starts. So we're up there on the hillside, January, February, peeling back the mat off the floor. So you can't grow grass on a florist floor. So we got to peel up all these pine needles, and I'm pulling all this stuff down. We get it all done. And we work crazy hours in January and February to get this done. And the comment I got all spring long, so we had to water it to kind of get, you know, get the turf to establish, is that we were just watering the rocks. You know, you can't grow grass, so that's just rock. You can, you know, and you know, eventually we were able to grow some grass, and it kind of filled in. But if you look at some pics of 12 and 18, you'll see some of the boulders and the rustic, you know, nature of that area, that natural terrain, and that's what we showcased. But members didn't get it. You know, like, members have a tendency not to be able to visualize the end product. You know, golfers are pretty good at visualization, but even though you're a member of a club, I'm sorry, you're not always a golfer. And so it was hard for them to grasp it. And so my office is on the 10th tee. So if I'm in my office, everybody would comment while I'm sitting there on my computer, what the hell are they doing over there? That looks like crap. You know, like, and constant until we got the turf to grow. So, you mean, you just got to suck it up. We knew it was the right decision. We knew it was. It took some time to establish. And every time you establish in native areas, it takes about 3 years to really kind of blend and fill in. We got it to fill in about a year and a half, you know, and to look like I was supposed to. But yeah, it was, I wasn't worried about losing my job or anything. But yeah, I had to put some earmuffs on while I'm in the office.
That has to be one of the toughest things about, you know, when you do changes is, like, it's not like any other profession. When you do something, it's like you get this brand new product. Like, you, it's as good as it's going to get.
You got members that have been there for 50, 60 years. Oh, it's always been this way. I hear that all the time. But and they're, you know, not a proponent of change, right? So when you make such a significant change, yes, there's a little pushback. But we believed in what we were doing. We did. And it was challenging. It was stressful. But that's also what makes it fun.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the, like, you talked about, you know, the mowing out, how you've done it on the cheap. What were some of the most cost-effective little things that you've done to save money?
We'll call them bunker restoration, whatever you want to consider that, but it's all in-house. So it's all, so the club has supplied us with two excavators, you know, a couple.
So it's buying the equipment on the front end.
You have to have the tools. Now, we push the tools to the limit because they don't make tools to scrape a hillside of rock, you know, force fall off the rock. I mean, we did some crazy stuff like chaining excavators to other skid steers so it didn't slide down the hill while we're, you know, popping stumps. But having the equipment, having the staff, it's an investment, but it's not a significant investment. And it's an investment that actually pays dividend later in the season because you have trained staff ready to go once we start maintaining.
So you're doing, you say you're building bunkers in-house.
Yep.
You know, obviously,
I wouldn't call them building. I'd say just,
yeah,
you know, sprucing them up. I would not, we're not doing build a bunker or anything like
how,
that.
How, you know, obviously you've got somebody like Bruce, who's like, yep, one of the best in the world at building bunkers. Yep. How much are you guys building something or like sprucing it up? We'll use,
yeah,
taking a step back, looking at it. Is it like, how often is it nailed? Do you have to redo a lot of work? Like, keep working on stuff.
We've only failed a couple times. Everybody fails.
This is the thing. Like, I try and write something, and something doesn't work out, and I'm just like, all right, I'm done with that. I X out the window, and I just forget about it. But like, if you fail, like, everybody, like, you know, it's a visible thing, right?
Everybody fails, and like, you know, some of our, you know, tee builds weren't that great, and we had to come back and redo, but. As long as the intention is the right intention, even if it doesn't pan out, at least you take those lessons, you take your lumps, and then you go back and you fix it. But if you're doing things in-house, it's not an expensive fix. It's just dedicating the time that it takes to fix it. But yeah, I learned a significant amount from Bruce in terms of how to operate a mini. He made that mini do things that I've never seen a piece of equipment do. And now I can do it, which is fun because it's, you know, he's got his headphones on and he's just, you know, he's playing. He's shaping clay, which is fun. And
it's amazing to watch one of those guys operate this huge piece of machinery and just like scrape like the smallest amount, and you're like, how?
And they're like, you know, they're taking the back of the bucket and you're like tapping the
bucket.
And it's fun. Like, it's so fun. I bought my own excavator for my house, like, so I could actually play. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What do you do in your house?
Well, I'm just reshaping the backyard. And
how much space is there?
I got about 2 acres of property. So, you know, taking some trees down and reshaping the property. And, you know, I don't sit still. So whether it's at work or at home, I continue to try.
So are you a superintendent that's got an immaculate yard?
No, God, no.
No?
No. Okay. I don't want to grow grass when I go home. I have lots of construction projects currently open, so I'm always playing. I'd rather go out there and play and build something.
What are you building?
Retaining walls, taking trees down.
What's
opening
the
up the landscape
wall for?
We put a pool in, and so we had to put. I had to build an 8-foot tall by 150-foot long retaining wall out of wood that I did myself.
I imagine that saves a lot of money.
Not when your wife told you not to do it to begin with, but yes. But yes, it saves money by me doing it, but it also keeps me out of the house, which is beneficial for my marriage. So
she probably likes the pool now, right?
She loves the pool. Yes. Yeah. So yeah. Now but now I've got a nice little area where we can put a green and a little chipping area in the back she doesn't know about yet.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's why you got the excavator.
Yeah,
right?
It's fun. It's fun to play. It's fun to, you know, that's my happy place is actually in an excavator.
Well, maybe you need to just, you know, change careers, get into golf construction, you know?
No, thank you.
the downside.
I know how to do construction at Essex. I'm not sure I know how to do construction elsewhere. Like, I know the ground at Essex, but, you know, and I have been fortunate enough to have teachers that help me along the way, too.
So you got to like do a lot of stuff because you got to get along with membership. You have to be part politician. Yep. You know, you have to then you're a people manager.
Yep.
You know, and then you actually have to do like you have to have tangible labor skills.
You know, you go to school to learn about turf, right?
You're like
a
scientist.
And you go get the job and the turf is the easy part, right? It's all the other stuff. You know, managing people is harder than anything I deal with. Yeah, you know, it is a challenge. You know, we have a great staff, but I call it the melting pot of America because it's every age, every ethnicity. And you just got to learn how to communicate with every single individual. It's not a broad brush and it's always a challenge, but it's always, you know, we're always a group. Superintendents are always a group that love challenge. Like we rise to the occasion.
What we're at this, the GCSAA show. I'm just trade shows. What are the big benefits of for you coming to this? You know, is it part networking, seeing people? I've been to this is my second one that I've come to. I'm just curious, like, you know, as somebody that's you used to be young, but you're becoming a veteran. You're not old.
I'm 43, but I'm not old, but I've been in the business a long time, but. Turf. I mean, the world has changed. The challenges for superintendents have never been greater. There's fewer people to hire. There is more pressure, and the standards aren't changing. They're getting tougher. So the only way to kind of work on that is to work together. That networking is important. You know, going to get education is fantastic. I'm going to sit through a bunch of seminars on turf related stuff. And then getting to the show floor and actually seeing what the new technology is, and not just what the next wave of new technology is, but stuff that maybe help us reduce our labor inputs, which is most likely our profession's biggest challenge moving forward.
What would be the best way to do that?
Autonomous mowing, number one. And you know, turf is always like the redheaded stepchild of ag, right? It's like everything goes to agriculture first, and we got to wait 10 years.
Have like autonomous everything.
Everything for a long time. This isn't recent technology. So we need to get to that point where we're, you know, people say we have too many inputs, and that's true, but most of our inputs, like labor, need to be reduced. Like these operations are not sustainable. You know, it's sustainable for a private club that has plenty of funding, but municipal golf is going to struggle if we don't find cheaper ways to maintain these golf courses.
That's what I think about Len Curtin, like all the time when I think about like challenging turf jobs. Len Curtin is the superintendent at George Wright.
Correct.
And it's like he works for a municipality. Everybody has to live in the city of Boston that he hires. He hires him for minimum wage. Yep. And then they have background testing and drug testing. It's
correct.
Like, I mean, you're making people jump through the hoop for a seasonal job, the minimum wage seasonal job with like manual labor.
Yeah. No, I'm the incoming vice president for the Golf Course Superintendent Association of New England.
Hey, congratulations on your
position. No, don't congratulate me. Feel sorry for me. but my biggest push is, you know, we don't pay people enough. You know, I'm well compensated, and Essex has done a great job with my staff. But our business does not support superintendents. They're the most valuable employee at every club. I'm sorry, general managers and pros, you're not. You know, I got a great professional, Jack Davis, at Essex, who is absolutely phenomenal, buys into everything we're doing. But it's the grounds crew. We're the ones protecting the assets. We're the ones creating the conditions.
Like you said at the beginning of the podcast, if the course is gone, there's nothing.
Exactly.
There's no general manager position.
If there's no shirts to fold, people are still playing golf, right? So
now you're coming after the pros.
I'm going after everybody on this one. I'm going to get a lot of emails. It's going to be fantastic. Come, GMs, you're next. but there are a significant amount of challenges in our industry, and it's not telling our environmental story well enough. We need to do better, but we haven't done enough telling what we do and how we do it. You know, golf is booming, and we need to take advantage of this this time, because if not, it's a lost opportunity.
It's you know, one of the things that I learned is that what I think is really ironic is, like, in most turf situations, the most, like, glamorous job is the mowing job.
Absolutely.
But the mowing job is, like, the most mindless job in the world. You're just sitting on a mower. And I think about it, it's like, so your most skilled, experienced labor goes to the thing that requires the least amount of skill. It doesn't make any sense.
People are going to be shocked by this, but I hate mowing grass. Because it's monotonous. I'd rather go set up a golf course every day. I change cups every day because that's my thing. I have a direct impact on who's playing that day. And if I want to torture them, I can. If I want to be nice, I can, which is a rarity. But that's fun to me. Mowing does, like, the art of mowing. There's an art and there's a system that needs to be in place. But it's a monotonous job.
All right. Well, we're excited to come back out there. That's the thing I'm most excited about.
We're excited to
see your course more.
Yeah.
What's the thing that you think you pick up? What's the thing you've picked up on the brilliance of the golf course over the years? Like, you know how, like, a lot of places you just learn so much more every time you go out there. What's something that you've picked up over the years about Essex?
With regards to my golf game?
No, about the golf course. Like, it could be to the smallest little drainage feature.
I mean, what I've gained appreciation for are our improvement on the green surfaces, because we have no internal drainage whatsoever. We do now. We're just putting it in now. But to be able to create those conditions on heavy clay through just aerations and top dressings over 15 years made a significant impact. Like, it's the biggest change on the golf course is the quality of the greens. I mean, was it Jack Nicklaus always said the biggest change at Augusta was going to bent grass, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like at Essex, the biggest change has been the quality of the putting surfaces. And that's what that's where it starts and ends for me. Like, you know, that's what Essex is about, is the green sites.
Yeah.
And if you don't have good greens, then you're just not a good superintendent.
Man, we'll end right there. You know, that's a perfect way to a perfect soundbite to send us off. So thanks for coming on the pod.
Yep.
How can, if people can, you're on Twitter. You got Instagram. You guys are an active grounds account. Great grounds account.
ECC Grounds 1893. Follow us. It's a private account, but I'll let you in if I like you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Erich Turf on Twitter.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast and our Superintendent Series. As a quick reminder, now is the time. Upgrade your office. Check out our print shop at proshop.thefriedegg.com and treat yourself to a print. You know, we have a bunch up there. We've got, we just added up Pinehurst to the print shop. So that's a, you know, it's a popular resort, but we have a lot of other popular resorts that have prints listed there. So check it out, and it's at proshop.thefriedegg.com, and get yourself something that spruces up the office. It's we're in the doldrums of winter. It'll get you to golf season.